universal desire by doing the opposite, posing questions and opening situations. Each turning point hooks curiosity. Concern, on the other hand, is the emotional need for justice, strength, survival, love, truth, courage, the positive values of life. As a story opens, the audience, consciously and/or instinctively, inspects the value-charged landscape of world and characters, trying to separate good from evil, right from wrong, things of value from things of no value. It seeks the center of good. Once it finds this core, emotions flow to it. The reason we search for the center of good is that each of us believes that we are good, or right, and we want to identify with the positive. Deep inside, we know we're flawed, perhaps seriously flawed, or criminal, but somehow we feel that despite that, our heart is in the right place. The worst of people believe themselves to be good. Therefore, no matter who's in the audience, each seeks the center of good, the positive focus for empathy and emotional interest. At the very least, the center of good must be located in the protagonist. Others may share in it, for we can empathize with any number of characters, but we must empathize with the protagonist. On the other hand, the center of good doesn't imply a Pollyanna notion of niceness. Good is defined as much by what it is not as what it is. From the audience's point of view, good is a judgment made in relationship to or against a background of negativity, a universe that's thought or felt to be not good. The Godfather. Not only is the Corleone family corrupt, so too are all the other mafia families, even the police and judges. Everyone in this film is a criminal or related to one. But the Corleones have one positive quality, loyalty. In other mob clans, gangsters stab each other in the back. That makes them the bad guys. The loyalty of the Godfather's family makes them the good bad guys. When we spot this positive quality, our emotions move toward it, and we find ourselves in empathy with gangsters. How far can we take the center of good? With what kind of monsters will an audience empathize? Silence of the Lambs. The writers of novel and screenplay place Carice at the positive focal point, but also shape a second center of good around Hannibal Lecter and draw empathy to both. First, they assign Dr. Lecter admirable and desirable qualities, massive intelligence, a sharp wit and sense of irony, gentlemanly charm, and most importantly, calmness. How, we wonder, could someone who lives in such a hellish world remain so poised and polite? Next, to counterpoint these qualities, the writers surround Lecter with a brutish, cynical society. His prison psychiatrist is a sadist and publicity hound. His guards are dimwits. Even the FBI, which wants Lecter's help on a baffling case, lies to him, trying to manipulate him with false promises of an open-air prison on a Carolina island. Soon we're rationalizing. So he eats people. There are worse things. Offhand, I can't think what, but we fall into empathy, musing, if I were a cannibalistic psychopath, I'd want to be just like Lecter. Curiosity and concern create three possible ways to connect the audience to the story. Mystery, suspense, dramatic irony. These terms are not to be mistaken for genres. They name story-audience relationships that vary according to how we hold interest. In mystery, the audience knows less than the characters. Mystery means gaining interest through curiosity alone. We create but then conceal expositional facts, particularly facts in the backstory. In suspense, the audience and the characters know the same. Suspense combines both curiosity and concern. 90% of all films, comedy and drama, compel interest in this mode. In suspense, however, curiosity is not about fact, but outcome. In dramatic irony, the audience knows more than the characters. Dramatic irony creates interest primarily through concern alone, eliminating curiosity about fact and consequence. Such stories often open with the ending, deliberately giving away the outcome. When the audience is given the godlike superiority of knowing events before they happen, its emotional experience switches. What in suspense would be anxiety about outcome and fear for the protagonist's well-being, in dramatic irony, becomes dread of the moment the character discovers what we already know and compassion for someone we see heading for disaster. Sunset Boulevard. In the first sequence, Joe Gillis floats dead, face down in Norma Desmond's swimming pool. The camera goes to the bottom of the pool and looks up at the corpse, and voice over, Gillis muses that we're probably wondering how he ended up in a swimming pool. So he tells us. The film becomes a huge flashback, dramatizing a screenwriter's struggle for success. We're moved to compassion and dread as we watch this poor man heading toward a fate we already know. We realize that all of Gillis's efforts to escape the clutches of a wealthy harridan and write an honest screenplay will come to nothing, and he'll end up dead in her swimming pool. Dramatic irony encourages the audience to look more deeply into the motivations and causal forces at work in the characters' lives. This is why we often enjoy a fine film more, or at least differently, on second viewing. We not only flex the often unused emotions of compassion and dread, but freed from the curiosity about facts and outcome, we now concentrate on inner lives, unconscious energies, and the subtle workings of society. However, the majority of genres do not lend themselves to either pure mystery or pure dramatic irony. Instead, within the suspense relationship, writers enrich the telling by mixing in the other two. In an overall suspense design, some sequences may employ mystery to increase curiosity about certain facts. Others may switch to dramatic irony to touch the audience's heart. Suppose you are working on a thriller about a psychopathic axe murderer and a female detective, and you're ready to write the story climax. You've set it in a dimly lit corridor in an old mansion. She knows the killer is near and clicks the safety off her gun as she moves slowly past doors left and right, extending into the dark distance. Which of the three strategies to use? Mystery. Hide a fact known to the antagonist from the audience. Close all the doors so that as she moves down the hall, the audience's eyes search the screen, wondering, where is he? Behind the first door, the next, then he attacks by crashing through the ceiling. Surprise. Suspense. Give the audience and the characters the same information. At the end of the hall, a door is ajar, with a light behind it, casting a shadow on the wall of a man holding an axe. She sees the shadow and stops. The shadow retreats from the wall. Cut two. Behind the door, a man, axe in hand, waits. He knows that she's there, and he knows that she knows that he's there because he heard her footsteps stop. Cut two. The hallway where she hesitates. She knows that he's there, and she knows that he knows that she knows that he's there, because she saw his shadow move. We know that she knows that he knows, but no one knows how will this turn out. Will she kill him, or he her? Dramatic irony. As Hitchcock might, hide from the protagonist a fact known to the audience. She slowly edges toward a closed door at the end of the hall. Cut two. Behind the door, a man waits, axe in hand. Cut two, the hallway as she moves closer and closer to the closed door. The audience, knowing what she doesn't know, switches its emotions from anxiety to dread. Don't go near that door. For God's sakes, don't open that door. He's behind that door. Look out! She opens the door and suddenly kisses the man with the axe. Man with axe, dialogue. I've been chopping wood all afternoon, honey. Is dinner ready? That's a false ending, and its dim-witted cousin, cheap surprise. The problem with false endings and cheap surprise is that we go to the storyteller with a prayer. Please let it be good. Let it give me an experience I've never had, insights into a fresh truth. Let me laugh at something I never thought funny. Let me be moved by something that's never touched me before. Let me see the world in a new way. Amen. In other words, the audience prays for surprise, the reversal of expectation. As characters arrive on screen, the audience surrounds them with expectations, feeling this will happen or that will change, Miss A will get the money, Mr. B will get the girl, Miss C will suffer. If what the audience expects to happen happens, or worse, if it happens in a way the audience expects it to happen, this will be a very unhappy audience. We must surprise them. There are two kinds of surprise, cheap and true. True surprise comes from the sudden revelation of the gap between expectation and result. This surprise is true because it's followed by a rush of insight, the revelation of a truth hidden beneath the surface of the fictional world. Cheap surprise takes advantage of the audience. We can always shock the vulnerability of the audience by smash-cutting to something it doesn't expect to see, or away from something it expects to continue. And in certain genres, horror, fantasy, thriller, cheap surprise is a convention and actually part of the fun. The hero walks down a dark alley. A hand shoots in from the edge of the screen and grabs his shoulder. The hero spins around. It's his best friend. Outside these genres, however, cheap surprise is a shoddy device. Because story creates meaning, coincidence would seem our enemy. For it is the random, absurd collisions of things in the universe and is, by definition, meaningless. And yet coincidence is a part of life, often a powerful part, rocking our existence, then vanishing as absurdly as it arrived. The solution, therefore, is not to artificially avoid coincidence, but to dramatize how it enters life meaninglessly, but in time gains meaning, and how the anti-logic of randomness becomes the logic of life as lived. The first principle of coincidence is to bring it in early to gain time to build meaning out of it. The inciting incident of Jaws occurs by coincidence. A shark feeding itself randomly happens to eat a swimmer. But once in the story, the shark doesn't leave. He stays and gathers meaning as he continuously menaces the innocent until we get the feeling that he's doing it on purpose and, what's more, enjoying it. Coincidence, therefore, must not pop into a story, turn a scene, and then pop out. As a rule of thumb, do not use coincidence beyond the midpoint of the telling. Rather, put the story more and more into the hands of the characters. And never, never use coincidence to get an ending. This is Deus ex machina, the writer's greatest sin. Deus ex machina is a Latin phrase taken from the classical theaters of Greece and Rome, meaning God from the machine. From 500 BC to 500 AD, theater flourished throughout the Mediterranean. Over those centuries, hundreds of playwrights wrote for these stages, but only seven have been remembered, the rest mercifully forgotten, due primarily to their propensity to use Deus ex machina to get out of story problems. Storytelling was as difficult 2,500 years ago as it is now, but ancient playwrights had a way out. They could cook up a story, twist turning points until they had the audience on the edge of their marble seats. Then, if the playwright's creativity dried up and he was lost for a true climax, convention allowed him to dodge the problem by cranking a god to the stage and letting Apollo or Athena settle everything. Who lives, who dies, who marries, who is damned for eternity. And they did this over and over. In essence, nothing has changed for 2,500 years. Writers today still cook up stories they can't end. But instead of dropping a god in to get an ending, they use acts of God. The hurricane that solves the lover's problem in Hurricane. The elephant stampede that resolves Elephant Walk. The traffic accident that ends The Postman Always Rings Twice. Deus ex machina not only erases all meaning and emotion, it's an insult to the audience. Each of us knows we must choose an act, for better or worse, to determine the meaning of our lives. No one and nothing coincidental will come along to take that responsibility from us, regardless of the injustices and chaos around us. We could be locked in a cell for the rest of our life for a crime we did not commit, but every morning we still have to get up in that hell and make meaning. Do I bludgeon my brains against this wall, or do I find some way to get through my days with value? Our lives are ultimately in our own hands. This is why Deus ex machina is such a terrible sin. It's a lie. Comedy writers often feel that in their wild world, the principles that guide the dramatist don't apply. But whether coolly satiric or madly farcical, comedy is simply another form of storytelling. There are, however, important exceptions that begin with a deep division between the comic and tragic visions of life. The dramatist is fascinated by the inner life, the passions and sins, madness and dreams of the human heart, but not the comedy writer. He fixes on the social life, the idiocy, arrogance, and brutality in society. The comedy writer singles out a particular institution that he or she feels has become encrusted with hypocrisy and folly, then goes on the attack. When a society cannot ridicule and criticize its institutions, it cannot laugh. The shortest book ever written would be The History of German Humor, a culture that suffers a paralyzing fear of the establishment and authority. Comedy is, at heart, an angry, antisocial art. To solve the problem of weak comedy, therefore, the writer first asks, "What am I angry about?" He finds that aspect of society that heats the blood and goes on an assault. All characters pursue desire against the forces of antagonism, but the dramatic character is flexible enough to step back from the risk and realize, "This could get me killed." Not the comic character. The comic character is marked by a blind obsession. The first step to solving the problem of a character who should be funny but isn't is to find his or her mania. Almost any obsession will do. In All in the Family, Archie Bunker was a blindly obsessed bigot. So long as he doesn't see it, he's a buffoon and we laugh at him. But if he were to turn to someone and say, "You know, I'm a rotten racist hate monger," the comedy is over. Comedy tolerates more coincidence than drama, and may even allow a Deus ex machina ending if two things are done. One, the audience is made to feel that the comic protagonist has suffered enormously. Two, he never despairs, never loses hope. Under these conditions, the audience may think, give it to him. At the climax of the gold rush, the little chap is nearly frozen to death, when a blizzard rips his cabin off the ground, blows it and Chaplin across Alaska, then drops him smack onto a gold mine. Cut two, he's rich, dressed to the nines, smoking a cigar, heading back to the States. The incisive difference between comedy and drama is this. Both turn scenes with surprise and insight. But in comedy, when the gap cracks open, the surprise explodes the great belly laughs of the night. If you pitch your story and people don't laugh, you've not written a comedy. You've written something else. But it isn't comedy. They didn't laugh. The solution, however, is not found in trying to devise clever lines or pies in the face. Gags come naturally when the comic structure calls for them. Instead, concentrate on turning points. For the reaction to each action, ask, "What's the opposite of that?" Then take it a step further to, "What's off the wall from that?" Spring gaps of comic surprise. Write a funny story. The conceit of adaptation is that the hard work of story can be avoided by optioning a literary work and simply shifting it into a screenplay. This is almost never the case. To grasp the difficulties of adaptation, we look again at story complexity. The 20th century has given us three media for telling story. Prose, the novel, novella, short story, the theater, legit, musical, opera, mime, ballet, the screen, film, and television. The unique strength and wonder of the novel is the dramatization of inner conflict. This is what prose does best, far better than play or novel, because it can directly invade the inner life and dramatize its conflicts at great length with density and poetic power. The unique command and grace of the theater is the dramatization of personal conflict. This is what the theater does best, far better than the novel or film, because personal conflicts are worked out, for better or worse, through talk. And in the theater, dialogue can be lifted to its most beautiful, subtle, complex, and expressive. The unique power and splendor of the cinema is the dramatization of extra-personal conflict. Huge, vivid images of human beings wrapped inside their society and environment, striving with life. This is what film does best, better than play or novel. If we were to take a single frame from The Blade Runner and ask the world's finest prose stylist to create the verbal equivalent of that composition, he or she would fill page after page with words and never capture its essence. And that is only one of thousands of complex images flowing through the experience of an audience. Nonetheless, the screenwriter cannot dramatize personal conflict to the poetic fullness of the theater, and while the inner life can be expressed impressively in film, it cannot reach the density or complexity of a novel. If you must adapt, look for stories in which conflict is distributed on all three levels with an emphasis at the extra-personal. First, read the work over and over without taking notes until you feel infused with its spirit. Do not make choices or plan moves until you've rubbed shoulders with its society, read their faces, smelled their cologne. That done, reduce each event to a one- or two-sentence statement of what happens and no more. No psychology, no sociology. For example, he walks into the house expecting a confrontation with his wife, but discovers a note telling him she's left him for another man. Period. That done, read through the events and ask yourself, is this story well told? Then brace yourself, for 9 times out of 10 you'll discover it's not. Or you'll discover it's beautifully told, a clockwork of perfection, but 400 pages long, 3 times as much material as you can use for a film, and if a single cog is taken out, the clock stops telling time. In either case, your task will not be one of adaptation, but reinvention. To reinvent, no matter in what order the novel's events are told, reorder them in time from first to last, as if they were the biographies of an original screenplay. From these, create a step outline using, where valuable, designs from the novel or play, but feeling free to cut scenes and, if necessary, create new ones. Seek a design that expresses the spirit of the original, yet within the rhythms of a film, ignoring the risk that critics may say, but the film's not like the novel. To learn adaptation, study the work of Ruth Prower Jabala. Like a chameleon or transmedium, she inhabits the colors and spirit of other writers. Read Quartet, Room with a View, The Bostonians. Pull a step outline from each novel, then scene by scene compare your work to Jabala. You'll discover a lot. Notice that she and director James Ivory restrict themselves to the social novelists, Jean Rhys, E.M. Forster, Henry James, knowing that the primary conflicts will be extra-personal and camera-attractive. No Proust, no Joyce, no Kafka. Playwright and novelist have always understood that their challenge is to do on stage or page what film does best. We compliment Flaubert's cinematic style long before there was cinema. Eisenstein said he learned to cut film by reading Charles Dickens. Shakespeare's stunning fluidity through time and space suggests an imagination hungry for a camera. Great storytellers have always known that show, don't tell, is the ultimate creative task. to write in a purely dramatic and visual way, to show a natural world of natural human behavior, to express the complexity of life without telling. By the same token, screenwriters have realized that their challenge is to do on screen what the playwright and novelist do best, to use images of character in their physical and social world to express and delineate personal and internal conflicts. Stories with holes lose credibility. The story lacks logic, a missing link in the chain of cause and effect. But like coincidence, holes are a part of life. Things often happen for reasons that can't be explained. So if you're writing about life, a hole or two may find its way into your telling. The problem is how to handle it. We could forge a link between illogical events and close the hole. This remedy, however, often requires the creation of a new scene that has no purpose other than making what's around it logical, causing an awkwardness as annoying as the hole. In which case, ask, will they notice? We know it's a jump in logic because the story sits still on our desk with its hole glaring up at us. But on screen, the story flows in time. As the hole arrives, the audience may not have sufficient information at that point to realize that what just happened isn't logical. Or the audience may be looking ahead, wondering what's going to happen next, and it passes unnoticed. Chinatown. Ida Sessions impersonates Evelyn Mulray and hires J.J. Gittes to investigate Hollis Mulray for adultery. After Gittes discovers what appears to be an affair, the real wife shows up with her lawyer and a lawsuit. Gittes realizes that someone is out to get Mulray, but before he can help the man, Mulray is murdered. Early in Act Two, Gittes gets a phone call from Ida Sessions, telling him that she had no idea that things would lead to murder, and wants him to know she's innocent. In this call, she also gives Gittes a vital clue to the motivation for the killing. Her words, however, are so cryptic, he's only more confused. Later, however, he pieces her clue to other evidence he unearths and thinks he knows who did it and why. Early in Act Three, he finds Ida Sessions dead, and in her wallet discovers a Screen Actors Guild card. In other words, Ida Sessions was an actress and couldn't possibly have known what she said over the telephone. Her clue is a crucial detail of a citywide corruption run by millionaire businessmen and high government officials, something they would never have told the actress they hired to impersonate the victim's wife. But when she tells Gittes, we have no idea who Ida Sessions is and what she could or could not know. When she's found dead an hour and a half later in the film, we don't see the hole because by then we've forgotten what she said. So maybe the audience won't notice. But maybe it will. Then what? Cowardly writers try to kick some sand over such holes and hope the audience doesn't notice. Other writers face this problem manfully. They lie. They expose the hole to the audience, then deny that it is a hole. Casablanca. Ferrari is the ultimate capitalist and crook, who never does anything except for money. Yet at one point, Ferrari helps Victor Laszlo find the precious letters of transit and wants nothing in return. That's out of character. Illogical. Knowing this, the writers gave Ferrari this line. Why I'm doing this, I don't know, because it can't possibly profit me. Rather than hiding the hole, the writers admitted it with a bold lie that Ferrari might be impulsively generous. The audience knows we often do things for reasons we can't explain. Complimented, the audience nods, thinking, even Ferrari doesn't get it. Fine. On with the film. A character, therefore, is no more a human being than the Venus de Milo is a real woman. A character is a work of art, a metaphor for human nature. We relate to characters as if they were real, but they're superior to reality. Their aspects are designed to be clear and knowable, whereas our fellow human beings are often a blur, difficult to understand, if not enigmatic. We know characters better than we know our friends, because a character is eternal and unchanging, while people shift. Just when we think we understand them, we don't. In fact, I know Rick Blaine in Casablanca better than I know myself. Rick is always Rick. I'm a bit iffy. Character design begins with an arrangement of two primary aspects, characterization and true character. Characterization is the sum of all observable qualities, a combination that makes the character unique. Physical appearance coupled with manners, style of speech and gesture, sexuality, age, IQ, occupation, personality, attitudes, values, where he lives, the way he lives. True character waits behind this mask. Despite their characterization, at heart, who is this person? Loyal or disloyal? Honest or a liar? Loving or cruel? Courageous or cowardly? Generous or selfish? Willful or weak? True character can only be expressed through choice in dilemma. How he chooses to act under pressure is who he is. The greater the pressure, the truer and deeper the choice to character. The key to true character is desire. In life, if we feel stifled, the fastest way to get unstuck is to ask, "What do I want?" Listen to the honest answer, then find the will to pursue that desire. Problems are still there, but now we're in motion with a chance of solving them. What's true of life is true of fiction. A character comes to life the moment we glimpse a clear understanding of his or her desire, not only the conscious, but in a complex role, the unconscious desire as well. Behind desire is motivation. Why does your character want what he wants? You have your ideas about motive, but don't be surprised if others see it differently. A friend may feel that parental upbringing shaped your character's desires. Someone else may think it's our materialistic culture. Another may blame the school system. Yet another claim it's in the genes. Still another think he's possessed by the devil. Contemporary attitudes tend to favor mono-explanations for behavior, rather than the complexity of forces that's more likely the case. Do not reduce characters to case studies, for in truth there are no definitive explanations for anyone's behavior. Generally, the more the writer nails motivation to specific causes, the more he diminishes the character in the audience's mind. Rather, think through to a solid understanding of motive, but at the same time leave some mystery about the whys, room for us to use our life experience to enhance your character in our imagination. In King Lear, for example, Shakespeare cast one of his most complex villains, Edmund. After a scene in which astrological influences, yet another mono-explanation of behavior, are blamed for someone's misfortune, Edmund turns in soliloquy and laughs, "I should have been what I am, had the maideniest star in the firmament twinkled on my bastardy." Edmund does evil for the sheer pleasure of it. Beyond that, what matters? As Aristotle observed, why a man does a thing is of little interest once we see the thing he does. A character is the choices he makes to take the actions he takes. Reasons why dissolve into irrelevancy. The audience comes to understand your character in a variety of ways. What the physical image and setting says a lot. But the audience knows that appearance is not reality, characterization is not true character. Nonetheless, a character's mask is an important clue as to what may be revealed. What other characters say about a character is a hint, but we know that what one person says of another may or may not be true, given the axes the people have to grind, but that it is said, and by whom, is worth knowing. what a character says about himself may or may not be true. We listen, but then put it in our pocket. Characters with lucid self-knowledge, those reciting self-explanatory dialogue meant to convince us that they are who they say they are not only boring, but phony. The audience knows that people rarely, if ever, understand themselves, and if they do, they're incapable of complete and honest self-explanation. There's always a subtext. If, by chance, what a character says about himself is actually true, we don't know it's true until we witness him make choices under pressure. Self-explanation must be validated or contradicted in action. In Casablanca, when Rick says, "I stick my neck out for no man," we think, "Well, not yet, Rick, not yet." We know Rick better than he knows himself, for indeed he's wrong. He'll stick his neck out many times. Dimension is the least understood concept in character. When I was an actor, directors would insist on round, three-dimensional characters, and I was all for that. But when I asked them what exactly is a dimension and how do I create one, let alone three, they'd waffle, mumble something about rehearsal, and stroll away. Some years ago, a producer pitched me what he believed to be a three-dimensional character in these terms. Jesse just got out of prison, but while he was in the slammer, he boned up on finance and investment, so he's an expert on stocks, bonds, and securities. He can also break dance. He's got a black belt in karate and plays a mean jazz saxophone. Jesse is as flat as a tabletop, a cluster of traits stuck on a name. Other writers have argued that fine characters are marked by one dominant trait, and often cite Macbeth's ambition. Overweening ambition, they claim, makes Macbeth great. Reading this, I concluded that they're dead wrong. If Macbeth were merely ambitious, there'd be no play. He'd simply defeat the English and rule Scotland. What makes Macbeth so brilliantly realized is the contradiction between his ambition on one hand and his guilt on the other. From this profound inner contradiction springs his passion, his complexity, his poetry. Dimension means contradiction. Either within deep character, guilt-ridden ambition, or between characterization and deep character, a charming thief. These contradictions must be consistent. It doesn't add dimension to portray a guy as nice throughout a film, then in one scene have him kick a cat. Consider Hamlet, the most complex character ever written. Hamlet isn't three-dimensional, but 10, 12, virtually uncountably dimensional. He seems spiritual until he's blasphemous. To Ophelia, he's first loving and tender, then callous, even sadistic. He's courageous, then cowardly. At times he's cool and cautious, then impulsive and rash, as when he stabs somebody hiding behind a curtain without knowing who's there. Hamlet is ruthless and compassionate, proud and self-pitying, witty and sad, weary and dynamic, lucid and confused, sane and mad. His is an innocent worldliness, a worldly innocence, a living contradiction of every human quality we could imagine. Dimensions fascinate. Contradictions in nature or behavior rivet the audience's concentration. Therefore, the protagonist must be the most dimensional character in the cast in order to focus empathy on the star role. If not, the center of good decenters. The fictional universe flies apart. The audience loses balance. In essence, the protagonist creates the rest of the cast. All other characters are in a story first and foremost because of the relationship they strike to the protagonist and the way each helps to delineate the dimensions of the protagonist's complex nature. Imagine a cast as a kind of solar system, with the protagonist as the sun, supporting roles as planets around the sun, bit players as satellites around the planets, all held in orbit by the gravitational pull of the star at the center, each pulling at the tides of the other's natures. Consider this hypothetical protagonist. He's amusing and optimistic, then morose and cynical. He's compassionate, then cruel, fearless, then fearful. This three-dimensional role needs a cast around him to delineate his contradictions, characters toward whom he can act and react in different ways at different times and places. These supporting characters must round him out so that his complexity is both consistent and credible. Character A, for example, provokes the protagonist's sadness and cynicism, while character B brings out his witty, hopeful side. Character C inspires his loving and courageous emotions, while character D forces him to cower in fear, then strike out in fury. The creation and design of characters A, B, C, and D is dictated by the needs of the protagonist. They are what they are, principally, to make clear and believable, through action and reaction, the complexity of the central role. Although supporting roles must be scaled back from the protagonist, they too may be complex. Character A could be two-dimensional, outwardly beautiful and loving, inwardly grotesque, as choices under pressure reveal cruel, mutated desires. Even one dimension can create an excellent supporting role. Character B could, like the Terminator, have a single yet fascinating contradiction, machine versus human. If the Terminator were merely a robot or a man from the future, he may not be interesting, but he's both. The machine-human dimension makes him a superb villain. Bit parts should be deliberately flat, but not dull. Give each a freshly observed trait that makes the role worth playing for the moment the actor's on screen, but no more. For example, suppose your protagonist is visiting New York City for the first time, and as she steps out of Kennedy Airport, she can't wait for her first ride with a New York taxi driver. How to write that role? Do you make him a philosophizing eccentric with a baseball cap sideways on his head? I hope not. For the last 6 decades, every time we get in a cab in a New York movie, there he is, the kooky New York cab driver. Perhaps you create the screen's first silent New York cab driver. She tries to start a New York conversation about the Yankees, the Knicks, the mayor's office, but he just straightens his tie and drives on. She slumps back, her first New York disappointment. On the other hand, the cab driver to end all cab drivers, a gravel voice but wonderfully obliging oddball who gives her a definitive tutorial in big city survival, how to wear a purse strap across her chest, where to keep her mace can. Then he drives her to the Bronx, charges her $150, and tells her she's in Manhattan. He comes on helpful, turns out to be a thieving rat. A contradiction between characterization and deep character. Now we'll be looking all over the film for this guy because we know that writers don't put dimensions in characters they're not going to use again. If this cabbie doesn't show up at least once more, we'll be very annoyed. Don't cause false anticipation by making bit parts more interesting than necessary. The cast orbits around the star, its protagonist. Supporting roles are inspired by the central character and designed to delineate his or her complex of dimensions. Secondary roles need the protagonist and each other to bring out their dimensions. As tertiary characters have scenes with the protagonist or other principals, they help to reveal dimensions in them as well. Ideally, in every scene, each character brings out qualities that mark the dimensions of the others. All are held in constellation by the weight of the protagonist at the center. Here are 3 tips on writing characters for the screen. First, leave room for the actor. This old Hollywood admonition asks the writer to provide each actor with the maximum opportunity to use his or her creativity, not to overwrite and pepper the page with constant description of behaviors, nuances of gesture, tones of voice. For example, Bob leans on the lectern, crossing one leg over the other, one arm akimbo. He looks out over the heads of the students, arching an eyebrow thoughtfully. Dialogue. Bob, parentheses, phlegmatically, close parentheses, blah, 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 blah. An actor's reaction to a script saturated with that kind of detail is to toss it in the trash, thinking they don't want an actor, they want a puppet. Or if the actor accepts the role, he'll take a red pencil and scratch all that nonsense off the page. The details are meaningless. An actor wants to know, what do I want? Why do I want it? How do I go about getting it? What stops me when I do? What are the consequences? The actor brings a character to life from the subtext out, desire meeting forces of antagonism. On camera, he'll say and do what the scene requires, but the characterization must be as much or more his work than yours. We must remember that unlike the theater, where we hope our work will be performed in hundreds, if not thousands, of productions here and abroad, now and into the future, on screen there will only be one production, only one performance of each character fixed on film forever. Writer-actor collaboration begins when the writer stops dreaming of a fictional face and instead imagines the ideal casting. If a writer feels that a particular actress would be his ideal protagonist, and he envisions her while he writes, he'll be constantly reminded of how little superb actors need to create powerful moments, and won't write this. Dialogue. Barbara. Parentheses. Offering Jack a cup. Close parentheses. Would you like this cup of coffee, darling? The audience sees it's a cup of coffee. The gesture says, would you like this? The actress is feeling, darling. Sensing that less is more, the actress will turn to her director and say, Larry, do I have to say, would you like this cup of coffee, darling? I mean, I'm offering him the damn cup, right? Could we cut that line? The line is cut. The actress sets the screen on fire, offering a man a cup of coffee. While the screenwriter rages, they're butchering my dialogue. Second, fall in love with all your characters. We often see films with an excellent cast of characters except one, who's dreadful. We wonder why until we realize that the writer hates this character. He's trivializing and insulting this role at every opportunity. And I'll never understand this. How can a writer hate his own character? It's his baby. How can he hate what he gave life? Embrace all your creations, especially the bad people. They deserve love like everybody else. Gail Ann Hurt and John Cameron must have loved their Terminator. Look at the wonderful things they did for him. In a motel room, he repairs a damaged eye with an X-Acto knife. Standing over a sink, he pries his eyeball out of his head, drops it in the water, mops up the blood with a towel, puts on gargoyle sunglasses to hide the hole, then looks up in the mirror and smooths down his tangled hair. The stunned audience thinks, he just pried his eyeball out of his head and he gives a damn what he looks like. He's got vanity. Then a knock at the door. As the Terminator looks up, the camera takes his point of view, and we see his computer screen superimposed over the door. On it is a list of responses to someone knocking. Go away. Please come back later. Fuck off. Fuck off, asshole. His cursor goes up and down while he makes his choice and stops at Fuck off, asshole. A robot with a sense of humor. Now the monster's all the more terrifying, for we have no idea what to expect from him and imagine the worst. Only writers who love their characters discover such moments. And a hint about villains. If your character's up to no good, and you place yourself within his being, asking, if I were him in this situation, what would I do? You'd do everything possible to get away with it. Therefore, you would not act like a villain. You would not twist your mustache. An interviewer once remarked to Lee Marvin that he had played villains for 30 years and how awful it must be always playing bad people. Marvin smiled and said, "Me? I don't play bad people. I play people struggling to get through their day, doing the best they can with what life's given them. Others may think they're bad, but no, I never play bad people." And that is why he was so brilliant at playing bad people. Marvin was a craftsman with a sympathetic understanding of human nature. No one thinks they're bad. If you can't love them for that, don't write them. Third, character is self-knowledge. Where do we find our characters? Partly through observation. Writers often carry notepads or pocket tape recorders, and as they watch life's passing show, collect bits and pieces to fill file cabinets with random material. When they're dry, they dip in for ideas to stir the imagination. We observe, but it's a mistake to copy life directly to the page. Few individuals are as clear in their complexity, as well delineated as a character. Instead, like Dr. Frankenstein, we build characters out of parts found. We take the analytical mind of our sister and piece it together with the comic wit of a friend. Add to that the cunning cruelty of a cat and the blind persistence of King Lear. We borrow bits and pieces of humanity, raw chunks of imagination and observation from wherever they're found, assemble them into dimensions of contradiction, then round them into these creatures we call characters. Observation is our source of characterizations, but understanding of deep character is found in another place. The root of all fine character writing is self-knowledge. One of the sad truths of life is that there's only one person in this vale of tears that we ever really know, and that's ourselves. We are essentially and forever alone. Everyone else remains at a distance, changing and unknowable in a definitive final sense. Yet, despite the obvious distinctions of age, sex, background, and culture, despite all the clear differences among people, the truth is we are all far more alike than we are different. We are all human. We all share the same crucial human experiences. Each of us is suffering and enjoying, dreaming and hoping of getting through our days with something of value. As a writer, you can be certain that everyone coming down the street toward you, each in his own way, is having the same fundamental human thoughts and feelings that you are. This is why when you ask yourself, "If I were this character, in these circumstances, what would I do?" the honest answer is always correct. You would do the human thing. Therefore, the more you penetrate the mysteries of your own humanity, the more you come to understand yourself as a human being, the more you are able to understand others.